Welcome to the Who's Counting podcast with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections.
Hello, I'm Cleta Mitchell. Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast about all things elections, how elections are supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do about it. And today we have a great guest who's going to talk to us about something that probably most of you have never heard of, but you need to know about these things because it's a threat coming to an election office near you. So I want to welcome Trent England, who is the executive director of Save Our States, and he's an expert on the things we're going to talk about today. So welcome, Trent.
Yeah, thank you so much, Cleta. It's great to be here.
Okay, so Trent, before we start talking about our subject matter, tell everybody a little bit about you, and then also tell them what is Save Our States.
Sure thing. So, I've been working kind of in and around election policy going back probably, 15 years, I guess, to kind of the time around when Washington State had a very questionable race for governor in 2004. Many people, and frankly, people on both sides of the aisle, thought that it was at least suspicious, maybe was outright stolen when Christine Gregoire became governor in a close race against the Republican Dino Rossi. And I was working at the Heritage Foundation at the time, mostly on other things, but got involved in that and then went back to Washington State and worked on elections at a time when Washington was transitioning from traditional voting to what eventually became universal vote by mail. And so really saw the downside of some of these ideas that folks have about how we can totally transform the way we do elections. And so from there, I wound up working on defending the Electoral College against the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact and created Save Our States to do that. Save Our States works to educate the public and to educate state legislators about the importance of the Electoral College and the real serious risk of this National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. So that's who I am and what I do.
Let's do talk for a moment about the Electoral College and what the Constitution says and what do you consider the threats to be?
Yeah. So, the Constitution creates the Electoral College as a multi-step way to choose the president, really based on a parliamentary system, and people oftentimes miss that. The rough draft of the Constitution, the Virginia Plan, would have created essentially a parliamentary system. Congress would have elected the president to get better separation of powers so you could have better checks and balances and better limits on federal power. The founders separated out the presidential election from Congress, but sort of kept that idea that you have states choosing delegates, the delegates choose the president. That became the Electoral College. But people miss that, and there's all kinds of weird conspiracy theories that the Electoral College was about slavery or about the founders being elitists. It was based on a model that's still used in most of the quote unquote democratic nations around the world. Britain, Canada, Australia, right? All these countries have a two-step process to choose their executive. And a part of the Electoral College is that the state legislature of each state has the power to figure out how to choose those presidential electors. And of course, today, every state holds an election. In most states, they elect all of the presidential electors as a slate. Maine and Nebraska break them up by congressional district. But you've got this group out there called National Popular Vote, and they, you have to give them credit, right? Folks may have very bad ideas, but it doesn't mean that they're foolish about how they go about trying to implement them. These people want to get rid of the Electoral College, but they know that amending the Constitution is not going to happen anytime soon. So they decided, let's try to get states to choose their presidential electors, ignoring what the people of their own state want, choose them based on the national popular vote. And they created this interstate compact. If they get states that control a majority of presidential electors into the compact, it takes effect. And they say, poof, you have the Electoral College hijacked, forced to rubber stamp the popular vote result. It is very savvy. I think it's unconstitutional for a variety of reasons, but I don't put my faith in federal judges either. This is really something I believe we have to stop at the state legislative level. And so that's our focus. But the other threat to the Electoral College really is that people just don't understand it. It's not, you know, it's not completely intuitive that we have this two-step process. Most Americans don't understand how a parliamentary system works. And so it makes it harder to understand the origin of the Electoral College and kind of what it's based on. And so we do a lot of work trying to educate Americans, you know, about the Electoral College specifically, but also about the fact that, you know, democracy is not a purpose of government. It's a process for government, right? I mean, all these things we talk about in elections are critically important. But at the end of the day, at least according to the American founders, the purpose was to create a stable government that protected individual rights. And so it's not just about, you know, cobbling together a majority or a plurality so that you know, group of people can tell everybody else what to do. It's a lot more complicated than even that, which helps explain why the Electoral College is important and checks and balances and the Bill of Rights and all those things too. So I think, you know, those are the things that we focus on. And, you know, the big threat to the Electoral College really is this National Popular Vote Compact that there are 15 states plus DC that control 195 electoral votes that have passed this compact. So they are more than 70% of the way, you know, if a court didn't stand in their way to hijacking the Electoral College. So, but we're working hard. You know, we have a lot of state legislators who we're working with to try to make sure this never happens.
So what can they do? What can state legislators do? Just simply block any bill to join this National Popular Vote Compact, or can they do something proactive to say, we're reaffirming our commitment to the U.S. Constitution that we swore to uphold when we took our oath of office?
That's right. I mean, it's all of the above. Legislators, you know, in states like Minnesota and Nevada, where there's a really serious push right now for the compact, you know, legislators just need to say no. In other states, you know, places like Arizona and Florida and South Dakota and North Dakota, where we've got a lot of legislators who want to stand up for the Electoral College, they've run resolutions. Some states actually have constitutional provisions that at least prevent that state from joining the compact. So that's a good thing. And we're trying to work with more states to do that, and also to potentially prepare. You know, the compact is very unique because you have it what would be a minority of states trying to rig the presidential election process, but they really need other states to go along. And so at the end of the day, I mean, if they get close to putting this compact into effect, or if they hit 270 electoral votes in the compact, there are some really direct things that states could do to say, look, we're not going to go along with this compact. And, you know, I mean, just to give one idea of what that might look like, you could have a state like Texas say, fine, you know, you say you want to create a national popular vote. We say that we have the power in our state to control how we run our election for presidential electors. We're going to let people vote individually for each presidential elector and report our popular vote total as the cumulative total of all those votes, thereby, you know, multiplying our results times, you know, was Texas up to 35. So there are some things like that that, you know, I don't think we want to do right now, but as it gets closer, there are, you know, the compact is a bad idea trying to overlay one election system on another. It has a lot of weaknesses that I think we can exploit, but hopefully we can just convince legislators to say no, to repeal it in some of the states where they have passed it, and to, you know, to put all this behind us. That I think is the best way to go forward.
Well, who's paying for this? This is a national effort, and I've heard tales about this National Popular Vote outfit taking flying legislators and people to exotic places and whining and dining them to support National Popular Vote. Who's paying for all that?
Yeah, I mean, it is a fabulously wealthy campaign. Most of the money, I believe, comes from John Koza. He invented the scratch-off lottery ticket back in the late 60s, patented it, turned it into a company, spent the 80s lobbying states, telling them, hey, adopt a lottery and you'll never have any school funding problems again, right? What? So yeah, he's that guy. And, you know, when you invent the scratch ticket, you sort of win on every ticket. So he has parlayed that wealth into pushing for this. He also has some support from George Soros' son, Jonathan Soros, who's kicked in at least a couple million dollars. So, it's an interesting and I think very representative of some of these election, reforms, these alternative election systems that we're going to talk about, where you have these very wealthy individuals who kind of latch onto an idea and, you know, and then they plow a fabulous amount of money. I mean, tens of millions of dollars behind some particular election idea that I think in some cases, it's always hard to tell, but I think in some cases, you know, these folks, they come from outside of politics, you know, they're frustrated and they think, oh, I'm so smart because I'm rich, so I must be smart. And if I like an idea, then that idea must be the perfect silver bullet solution that's going to solve all of our problems, right? Whatever they think those problems are. And election reform draws an interesting and kind of different cast of character, along with some of the same old, you know, Soros folks that we see in you know, all the bad ideas that are out there.
Anything that might undermine the Constitution, basically disrespect the founding and the history of our constitutional republic, starting with calling it a democracy, which it isn't. They specifically rejected that. So Soros has been funding many of those things, but he's not the only billionaire. The left has so many billionaires who are willing to spend money to undermine America, which is how they and the country that we have is why they're billionaires. But I don't know. I don't get it. But I do hope that I'm so glad you've been out there identifying this problem, fighting it for several years. And which brings us to that this isn't the only bad idea that leftist billionaires are supporting. I saw a report at the Election Assistance Commission, EAC.gov, on something called, it was published in March of this year, and it's something called, the paper is called Alternative Voting Methods in the United States. I thought, oh gosh, I can't wait to read this. So, Trent, you have been, in addition to your fight for to save the Electoral College and our Constitution, talk to us about what is an alternative voting system? What are they talking about?
Yeah, it sounds very innocuous, like maybe it's some technical thing that happens in the background or something, but that's absolutely not what folks are talking about. I mean, what's being pushed here, whether it is approval voting or ranked choice voting or star voting or some variant of these, some of these really, really radical changes to the primary process when people talk about top two or jungle primaries or final four or final five voting like they've pushed on people in Alaska, these change the way that elected officials are chosen. And the biggest, I mean, to kind of cut to the chase here, the thing that all of these people miss, every single campaign for one of these systems, is that when the American founders designed the systems that we have today, and then as they grew up very early in our republic and developed, in many cases, really during the generation when the founders were still there, the focus was on, how does an electoral system, like what kind of government does an electoral system produce? It wasn't about vague ideas of fairness, right? Especially mathematical ideas of fairness. Well, all that matters is that we just try to make everything mathematically perfectly fair and then close our eyes to the outcomes. The founders, frankly, didn't care about the inputs. They cared about the outcomes. They cared about having a government that was stable enough to produce prosperity and protect individual rights and protect itself against foreign enemies, right? And so, that's how they thought about elections. None of these people think about it that way. They think about it in terms of mathematical abstractions. And so, and as you said, they have no respect for the Constitution. And in many cases, I think that they see anything that sort of changes, rips up little parts of the Constitution or our constitutional order, they see that as, you know, it must be a good thing, right? Because those guys were ignorant, they were bigots. You know, how could they possibly be as smart as a billionaire in the 21st century, right? I mean, that's how all these folks seem to think. So, I mean, what they're trying to do is change the way that we vote so they can change the results of elections so that they can change our country. And, you know, I think nobody should be misled by kind of the bumper stickers about, oh, this is a little more fair, or elections are going to be a little more nice, right? That's not why the people who support these things support them. And it's not likely to be the outcome either. That's what I think is going on here at kind of the 30,000 foot level.
And these alternative voting methods, which is just another step in the continuum from the national popular vote to this, these various, and we're going to go through and talk about each one of them, these alternatives to what we're used to is candidates file for office, a particular office, they campaign, we watch, we listen. Maybe we just say, okay, I'm going to vote for the Republican, I'm going to vote for the Democrat. A lot of people do that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But people choose and they go to the polls and they say, this is who I'm voting for.
Yeah.
Now, and then they count up and whoever gets the most vote wins.
That's right.
Very clean. So it's very clean, very simple. Get that. And I will tell you, even that, the number of voters who have problems with marking the ballot properly or expressing their desires properly or whatever, that's a big problem in our election system. But even with just saying, choose, here are the candidates, pick one, that seems to be that. But that's how we're used to it. Now, talk to us about let's start with, where should we start? Should we start with the primaries, the jungle primaries?
Yeah.
Explain that is. What do we do? What do most states do now? And then what would this do?
That's a great place to start because that's where the whole process starts, right? With how candidates are chosen. And one of the challenges is that we have two different kinds of processes, right? I mean, we have nonpartisan elections, which oftentimes is the proving ground for these ideas, which is to say, it's an apples to oranges comparison because they'll say, oh, well, some little town uses this strange voting system, so obviously we could use it statewide. Well, apples to oranges, right? So in a typical election, you have the primary, the Republicans go and choose their candidate, the Democrats go, they choose their candidate. It used to be that the parties met in conventions and chose their candidates, which, I think we're not here to talk about this, but I do think that some of the folks who are upset with our politics today, who think that it's become so nasty and divisive, they forget that some of those things may be the result of previous reforms, like creating these nominating processes, like open primaries, these processes where the parties don't have as much control over their candidates. I mean, that's at least a real possibility that is what is one of the things that's led to some of the fracturing that we see today. But so the reformers want to take away political parties from the process.
That's true. Yeah, the left really hates political parties. Yeah. I have a lot of theories about that, but having fought the fight on campaign finance, in the early 2000s, late 1990s, early 2000s, it was pretty clear that the funders, and again, a very well-funded left-wing donors, left-wing foundations giving money to, Open Society Institute, all of the, usual suspects, to get rid of to really diminish the role of the political parties. And what's interesting is what people didn't realize is that it was really the Republicans who had a big tent political party where they brought in the wealthy donors as well as the grassroots conservative groups. And they all were under that one big tent. And whether they liked each other or not, the party more or less was able to kind of hold those together. The Democratic Party was never like that. The Democratic Party is more like a federation of interest groups. And so when all of the McCain-Feingold really diminished the parties and broke it all up for the Republicans, the Democrats really didn't impact them because they'd been that federation. Labor unions were the biggest soft money donors to the DNC. Yeah. And all it said is, you can't give money to the DNC anymore, which is fine. They go, that's fine. We'd rather keep it and spend it ourselves anyway. So In any event, it's just, but it's, the left is always about rewriting rules. And, but they really, and I realized back in during that fight, they really hate, you know, these people who go to conventions and wear donkey hats or elephant pins. They're elitist and they look down on those people. And I think that it's interesting because I guess that's what you're saying. That's why they want to rub out political primaries.
Yeah. It is really, and it's really odd. And the media, you know, the media just miseducates people about what's going on because the parties are the place where things are, in a certain sense, really democratic, or at least really bottom up, right? Anybody who wants to show up can show up and can participate and can move up from the precinct caucus to the county, to the state, potentially to the federal level. I mean, that is a very, you know, the way I think about it, at least, a very democratic process in the, you know,
small d.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, the left doesn't, you know, these left-wing billionaires, they don't want to have to show up at their precinct caucus. They don't want to have to go to their county convention and win the votes of people in donkey hats, right? They don't, they're better than that in their own eyes, right? And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I lived through all this in Washington State, going to a jungle primary.
Okay, so tell everybody, what is a jungle primary? So so you were talking about, we have Democrats and Republican primaries, used to be conventions. Some states still do nominating conventions for some offices where the convention meets and they choose their nominees and they run into general. Okay, so we have jungle primaries, right? So what do we traditionally, whether the Republicans vote for theirs, Democrats vote for theirs?
Yeah. So this is, I mean, the progression really has been, yeah, Republicans vote for their nominee, Democrats vote for their nominee. And then you see open primary laws, which is where anybody who wants to can vote in the Republican primary, or anybody who wants to can vote in the Democrat primary, which is where you get this problem where Democrats will say, oh, we're going to all vote in the Republican primary for somebody we think is going to be easy to beat, right? Or a moderate squish or whatever. But you get the open primaries, that breaks it down a little bit. And then you get the jungle primaries, which is all the candidates, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, whatever, they all run on the same ballot. And people vote for one of those candidates. And then the candidates that get the top two votes, or sometimes it's the top four or the top five, usually combined with some other changes to the general election, all those candidates go to the general election. So the top two, if the top two vote getters are both Democrats, then the general election just has two Democrats and Republicans don't have anybody to vote for, or vice versa. I mean, this happened in Washington State in an election where Democrats sort of manipulated the process to squeeze out an incumbent Republican and replace him with a weaker Republican. So this was a jungle primary combined with the fact that it's inherently an open primary. So Democrats are able to manipulate the Republican votes and wind up in an election between a Democrat and a Republican, with the Republican incumbent not even making it to the primary, because the Democrats had sort of, you know, played both sides. That's the jungle primary, or the top two primary, or as I said, sometimes the top four or the top five, usually in combination with ranked choice voting. And people just should be very attuned to this. I mean, it creates a system that can be more easily manipulated. It creates a system where the parties, and when we say the parties, you know, we don't mean six guys in a room full of cigar smoke, right? We mean the people who show up to the meetings and who actually are involved and have, you know, they have a real sense of ownership in the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians for that matter, right? We're talking about those people having the ability to choose the person who represents them in the election, carries their banner in the election. You know, breaking that down introduces all of this instability and all of this gamesmanship into the beginning of the electoral process.
Well, the thing that makes me so upset about it, and I think all we have to do is look at California. California now has that. So it used to be, and in fact, there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision where, and I don't know why the Republicans haven't brought this suit again. The Democratic Party brought it the first time, where the Supreme Court ruled that the legislature, the government, had no authority to go in and dictate to political parties how they choose their nominees, because that there is a freedom of association to be part of a political party. And so that party has the right to decide how it's going to choose its nominees. But what's happened with these jungle primaries is that you get, as you say, you end up with two candidates all over California. You get two Democrats running, you know, that's what you have to choose. Well, if you're a Republican or a Libertarian or a Green Party, you don't have a choice. You have nobody representing you on that ballot. And that's, but, you know, you look at what's happened when they've started manipulating this process in Washington State. Washington State used to be competitive between Democrats and Republicans. Not anymore. Now that you have all mail voting and you have all this stuff that's happened with the these changes in the primary and the there's no ability of a huge swath of the electorate to have their voice even heard, or there's no ability to be able to legitimately participate. That's my observation.
I think that's right. And it's ironic because you have the folks who talk the most about minority rights creating a situation where the minority just disappears. People go and vote on their ballot. And as you say, there's two Democrats, right? They don't have a real choice. Or, you know, in some rural districts in Washington State and in California, you may have two Republicans occasionally, right? But you don't, I mean, at that point, you really have a sense that there is no power for the minority at all, right? And I think for an average voter, you know, it's very easy for these reformers to say, well, I mean, people have a choice and most people want a Democratic choice, so they have a choice between two Democrats. But for the average voter, that doesn't really feel like a real choice. And that is putting this abstract mathematical fairness over a system that's actually healthier and better for a republic, right? Where the opposition is present and can, you know, if that incumbent Democrat in Seattle does something really abhorrent, there's a real alternative who you can vote for on the ballot. I mean, I think that's a good thing, but these reformers want to squelch all that out.
Well, they're not very tolerant of differing points of view. So to them, I guess, having all the candidates share the same political philosophy is a good thing because it keeps the pesky conservatives from being able to have anything to say. Okay, so we talked about jungle primaries. Let's talk about, and sort of top four, top two, let's talk about ranked choice voting. That's been, over the last several years, that's been a big push of the leftist billionaire reform movement. Yeah. Talk about that. What is that?
Yeah, and this is what's usually coupled with that final four or final five or top four, top five primary system. It's what they did in Alaska. It's what they put on the ballot in Nevada. They're trying to get it on the ballot in I think, Missouri again this year. So ranked choice voting is a really complicated system that was invented in the 19th century for multi-candidate races. So this is, you know, that would be where people are electing three or five, you know, members of a parliament or a city council or something. But
in a single district. In one district, you might have.
Yeah.
Or and you might have multiple candidates. Or Florida used to do that with its state senate, where they had multi-member districts, so that you would really not just have, I live at 123 Smith Street, I might have more than one person representing me. State senate.
And that, New Hampshire has that in a certain way, and And that, I think, is important for us to keep in the back of our minds, because the group that is the primary advocate for ranked choice voting, a group called Fair Vote, what they really want is to use ranked choice voting to go to these multi-member districts with proportional representation, which, you know, we don't have to get into all of that, just to say they have an even more, but, you know, whether it's electing multiple or just one candidate, the fundamental process for ranked choice voting is that instead of voting for one candidate, voters can rank a number of candidates. And this is where we get to our kind of first level of complexity, because not all of these systems are the same. In Minneapolis, voters can rank up to three. In some places, voters can rank up to five. In some places, like Maine does this in some of their elections, voters can rank as many candidates as are on the ballot for that one race. So if you have 12 candidates for for a legislative primary, they use it in Maine, or for a city council race or something, you can rank all 12. And when those votes are counted, they count up the first place votes. And if no candidate has a majority of first place votes, then they look at the candidate with the least number of first place votes and they delete that candidate and they take all of the, anyone who voted for that candidate, they take their second place vote and move it up to be their first place vote. And then they count again. And so, so then you're basically taking the least popular candidate in each round, shifting all the votes on those ballots up, and then recounting, and then doing it again, adjusting and recounting and adjusting and recounting until someone has over 50% of the remaining votes. And it's really important to say remaining votes, because one of the sales pitches for ranked choice voting that I think is a huge Achilles heel of theirs is that it guarantees a majority winner, which is totally false. There's academic literature out there to prove this, but anybody can just go and look at ranked choice voting results and see, as you go through every one of those adjustments and recounting, you get ballots thrown out because a lot of voters don't want to rank all those candidates. Right. I mean, especially in a, if you got 12 people, they might rank their top two or three or maybe four. But once you get, once you get into the seventh, eighth, ninth round, which often happens in these races where you have a whole bunch of candidates, a lot of ballots have been thrown away. And at that point, you're not talking
about... this is interesting. Let me just start right here. It means, thrown away, it means that in that round, my vote, if I said, there are only two people that I can vote for because these other five people... are for things that I'm not for, and they're against things that they're not against the things that I want to be against. So I'm only going to vote for these people out of principle. So we get to the next round, and I have only voted for two or three. So we get to the next round. My vote isn't even counted.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And it is as if you didn't vote, which
at all.
It's an interesting difference, right? When you get to the end result in one of these ranked choice voting tabulations, you're going to have two candidates left. And typically, you're going to have two candidates left. And so if you voted for any other candidate, it's as if you didn't even show up. You disappear from the denominator. And the only reason they do that really is because they want to pretend like the winner under ranked choice voting had a majority.
An interesting point, Trent. It's only a majority of those still standing.
Yeah.
And so it's the more ballots you mark, the more candidates you mark, the better, it's only of the majority of the people who marked more candidates.
There's an academic paper where they looked just at ranked choice voting elections where ranked choice voting had mattered, right? So it wasn't decided on the first round. And they found that almost never does the winner have a majority among
the total
ballot cast. That's right.
Oh my gosh. That's very interesting.
Yeah. So. And that's one of their core premises. I mean, you'll find this on ranked choice voting all the time. It guarantees that the winner has a majority. I mean, and even if you have a race among 10 people and you hold a gun to voters' heads and you say, you must rank all 10 of these candidates, what is my seventh place rank really? The winner had a mathematical majority, but again, that's an abstraction. That doesn't mean that the person I ranked seventh on my ballot is somebody I wanted to. I mean, at some point, I'm really saying, look, I don't like this person, but I don't like them a little bit less than I don't like this other person, right? I'm not saying I want this person to govern me. So, yeah.
Well, it looks to me like, Maine. The way it passed in Maine, the way it passed in Alaska was through putting it on the ballot through the initiative process. They're both small states. It just barely passed in Alaska a lot of funding from the proponents. And I don't know that there was any funding explaining to people why they ought to vote against it. Same thing happened in Maine. And same thing in Nevada, relatively small state for purposes of putting it on the ballot. And there's just no money that's being spent to fight these ballot initiatives. And what's happened is in Maine, what had been a Republican congressional seat is no longer a Republican congressional seat. In Alaska, a conservative state, what had been historically a pretty Republican state now has a Democrat in the House, U.S. House, representing them, thanks to ranked choice voting. Lisa Murkowski, who can barely be called a Republican, truly a Republican in name only. And the state legislature is evenly split. And that just, to me, does not seem representative of the sentiments of the people of Alaska.
Yeah, it's so I think Maine and Alaska are good examples of what the outcomes are.
That they want.
Voting with it they want. And yeah, these are the outcomes that they want, right? They do this for a couple of reasons. In a state like Maine, it allows the political left to use far left candidates as a way to generate turnout for Democrats, essentially, right? So they have these further left candidates, and when those folks turn out and vote, they're going to give their second place vote to the Democrat. They're going to be, you know, they're going to be eliminated in the ranked choice voting round, and then those votes are going to go to the Democrat. And of course, some of those voters wouldn't have shown up if they weren't voting for this further left candidate. So that the left is using this so that the left wing fringe parties become get out the vote tools for the Democratic Party, and that's worked fairly well for them, it seems, in some of those places. And then in Alaska, they do it because it punishes candidates who take principled positions, because obviously you take principled positions that alienate some people, right? You know, if you stand up for strong views on any issue, and you see some of the people pushing ranked choice voting, they think that's a plus, right? They want these sort of wishy-washy, centrist quote unquote candidates rather than having a real clear debate over the issues and over principles, which, I don't think that is a better political system to reward people who kind of fly beneath the radar. I don't think that's a good thing at all.
Well, it's really shocking to me that we're even having to have this conversation, but the left has spent so much money and is still spending so much money attacking our election system. I want to go through some of these other things in this paper that was published by the Election Systems Commission and have you talk about some of these. What is approval voting?
So approval voting is where you can just vote for as many of the candidates as you quote unquote approve of. And this has also been filed as a ballot measure in Missouri. This year, we'll see whether they really push approval voting or ranked choice voting there. I'm not 100% sure what the strategy is for these folks there, but it is used in some cities, and you just vote for as many candidates as you approve of, and then they add up all those votes, and whoever has the most approval votes wins. I mean, the benefit versus ranked choice voting is at least it's a lot simpler. You don't have all this weird adjusting and recounting. But the problem with approval voting is, I mean, number one, it's still more complicated, and you have this situation where voters get more than one vote. You don't have one person, one vote, and one voter will choose to vote for one person, one voter will choose to vote for three or five or whatever, and so that becomes an issue on the sort of auditing side, right? You can't just, you're going to have more votes than you have voters in any approval voting election,
right?
The real problem I have with it is it even fails sort of the mathematical abstraction, fairness test, right, that these folks talk about. Because in approval voting, every time when you cast that second vote, you're actually weakening your first vote, right? And so the people pushing this system, they say, oh, you need to vote, and they'll even put it on the ballot. They'll say you must vote for every candidate you approve of. They really want to push people, because the strategic voter will just vote for one candidate, because that gives the most power to your vote. So, I mean, this again is it's a system because it's more complicated, it's easier to game, doesn't really live up to the promises. And the people who are pushing the system have to sort of try to push around voters to make them do what they want in order to you know, try to keep them from gaming the system, which we all know isn't going to work. So, yeah, that's approval voting.
And what is cumulative voting?
So cumulative voting is where you vote. You can vote for, this is in a multi-member district.
Like we were talking about a moment ago.
Yeah. So if you have five, you're electing, say, five people, and there's 20 people running, you have five votes, and you can cast those votes however you want.
Oh, so I could actually cast all five of my ballots for one candidate.
For one candidate, you could pick five of the 20, cast two for one and one for each of three more. Yeah, and I mean, this apparently is used in some places. Frankly, I've never really seen this before because most of the U.S. doesn't have multi-member districts, right? So so it's, you know, these things, these multi-member systems are not as much of an issue, but yeah, I mean, this, you know, you can find these things used in a few places in the U.S. and a few places in other countries.
It's just so, why do they want it to be so complicated? Do they just want us to stay home? Is that really what they want? Do they really just want us to stay home?
I think, yeah, there is a little bit of a literacy test flavor to some of this, especially when you talk to the advocates for it, right? The, you know, of course, for listeners, viewers, right? The literacy tests were, you know, this was a tool of the Jim Crow South, you know, and I don't know if it was ever really used in sort of a legitimate way or not, but right, they would say, well, you have to prove that you can read and write in order to vote. Well, you know, maybe we hope voters are educated, but we also respect the fact that there are plenty of people in our country's history who couldn't read or write, who were great, wise, you know, hardworking people who deserve to be able to vote. And the Voting Rights Act of 1965 outlawed literacy tests in federal elections pursuant to the 15th Amendment. And you get that from, I mean, I've had conversations with advocates for ranked choice voting where I say, look, you know, a lot of voters, this is going to be very confusing to them. And you look at the exit polls, a lot of voters don't, they just vote for one candidate in ranked choice voting, which means that their odds of being disenfranchised go up. And minority voters actually do that in higher numbers, right? Which means this has a disparate impact against minority voters, which you would think people on the left would have a problem with. And sometimes the response you get is kind of a variant of, well, if people can't figure this system out, maybe they shouldn't be voting anyway.
Right. Yeah. And that's what they would accuse us of saying. But yeah, this is a mathematical literacy test.
Yeah. That's right.
You read it right. This mathematical literacy. Yeah.
And you think about the people pushing this in many cases are people who say you can't have voter ID because that's too hard for voters. But hey, we've got a brand new election system that makes ballots longer and more complicated, and it's harder to count it all up and understand what it means, right? I mean, that very odd, at least.
What is star voting? I never heard of that one until I read this paper. So if that's not something you're familiar with, don't worry about it.
Oh,
I've
no,
never heard of it.
There are some very zealous advocates out there for star voting. I have seen these people at conferences. So star voting, it stands for, and I kept it written.
I got it right here. Let's see.
Yeah, it stands for score, then automatic runoff. And it's but here's how they sell it. And I think this is clever. So I, you know, they give the other side their due. They sell it as this is just like Yelp or Rotten Tomatoes. You're giving candidates stars, right? 0 to 5 stars. I mean, and
oh my gosh.
Yeah. This is, you know, to which most people say, well, you know, choosing a governor is not like rating a restaurant, right? But that's how they sell it. And that's what voters do. They, you know, so you can say, oh, well, you know, this candidate is my 5-star candidate and this other candidate, 3 stars. Then maybe this other candidate's 3 stars also. And then this candidate's 1 star and these other 2 candidates, no stars. Don't like them at all, right? And the way it works is they add up the points And the candidates who have the top two number of the most stars go to a runoff, and then they look back at the ballots, and they between those two candidates, they count them up so that if a voter, you know, if a voter gave two stars to one of those candidates and one star to the other, then that ballot counts for the two-star candidate, right? And if a voter gave five stars to one of those and two stars to one of those, then that counts as a vote for the five-star candidate, right? So, I mean, again, you have a multi-stage election. It's like a combination of approval voting and ranked choice voting. And like I say, I mean, there's a real push for this out there. I don't quite understand why. I think maybe it's people have been, you know, scrolling on Yelp too much.
But here's what I'm sitting here trying to figure out. How do you program a voting machine? How does a tabulator deal with all this? I mean, I know, for instance, that there was an Oakland.
Yeah.
What is that? Alameda County. Is that the name of the county?
Alameda County.
Alameda County, California, last November, school board election. There was a program that using ranked choice voting, and they gave the seat to the person who actually finished last instead of the person who actually won because there was a, quote, programming error. Well, how in the world, if this is widespread, these cockamamie ideas, how do you program election machines and tabulators and have any sense of confidence that it's been done correctly?
That's right. I mean, ranked choice voting is the ultimate black box voting system, right? Because all of that data gets fed into a computer, and the computer is going to kick out the results, make the adjustments. I mean, on a small scale, ranked choice voting ballots could be hand counted. But as soon as you get to a large scale, I mean, that is almost impossible, right? And so it's very reliant on the technology. And it also creates, like happened in the Oakland school board race, these weird questions, you know, additional questions about what you do with ballots that aren't filled out quite as expected. What happened in Oakland is that I think it was 209 voters in that race didn't fill out a first place rank, but they did rank some other candidates. And there's no obvious answer for what you do with that, right? You could just hold those in if the election goes to a second round, because you might say, well, the intent of those voters is to say, we don't really like any of these candidates that much, so we're not going to give anybody our first place rank. Or you might say, well, maybe the intent was that they just made a mistake and they just missed that first place column somehow. And so what the rules said was that in that scenario, all the rankings should just be moved up once at the beginning before the voting starts. But instead, the way the machine was programmed, those ballots were just ignored in the first round. And I mean, and again, with a normal plurality election, most of the answers to questions like this are just obvious. You could ask a five-year-old, right? Well, what do you do in a plurality election if somebody marked their ballot for two candidates? Well, you can't count it because you don't know which candidate they want. What if they left it blank? Well, you don't count it because it's blank, right? But in a ranked choice voting election, there's all these ambiguities, right, that somebody behind the scenes decides how they deal with. And in that election, it made all the difference. It flipped who the winner was, whether you flip this toggle switch in the software one way or the other. And the people who ran the election didn't find out about it until, yeah, they'd certified the election. And it was the day before Christmas Eve. Some ranked choice voting advocate, actually, who'd been doing they've been doing audits of these ranked choice voting elections to talk about how great they are. Well, they discovered this mistake and they didn't want anybody else to discover it later. And so they called Alameda County and said, you guys better go back through not just that race. They had to go back through every single race in that county and retabulate them all. That was the only one where it flipped the outcome, but it easily could have flipped the outcome in any number of races there. And they actually lucked out that it was only one. And yeah, I mean, that the wrong winner ended up serving on that school board for, I think, about a month. So now it's that story just encapsulates, I think, all the problems we're talking about, right? It's more complicated for voters, for election administrators, and you can't obviously see the mistakes that are being made because so many of them happen in the black box.
Well, one of the things I've been told, and I have not researched this myself, you may know the answer to this, that in Alaska, in the general election in 2022, that there was a drop off in turnout among what had historically been what political operators might call, you know, the ones, the people who always vote. No matter what, they always vote. There's a group of voters. I'm one of them. I vote in everything. You know, wow. If there's an election, I'm voting. I've always been that way. But that there was a precipitous drop off among the regular voters, Republicans, Democrats, independents, minor parties, did not matter. There was just a drop off in that voter turnout. Have you looked at anything like that at turnout?
I've looked at the general turnout. It went way down in Alaska in 22. That's really interesting. I hadn't looked at that, although in terms of voter propensity, but that's not surprising because a lot of those voters, I'm one of those voters too, right? I vote in everything, right? But a lot of those voters would be people like, you know, like maybe our parents, right? Like, You tend to see that, right? That your older retired voters are your very high propensity voters. And when you look at the research on ranked choice voting, those are the people most likely to be confused by the system. And also to have that kind of skepticism that, hey, I mean, if you're telling me we can't run elections in a normal way that I can understand, like, I just don't want to have any part in this anymore. And so,
I'm thinking about people in nursing homes. We worry about vulnerable voters. I'm thinking about disabled voters.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about, you know, all of these laws that require you print ballots, you have ballots in multiple languages. I mean, the complexity of this is staggering. Yeah. And I just worry about the chaos that ensues.
Well, you mentioned disabled voters. And I think that's a special case that people should think about, too. You have particularly voters who are blind who vote with auditory systems. Now, it's not that big of a deal if it says, do you want Donald Trump and Mike Pence or Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, right? I mean, that's pretty easy to do in an auditory system. But if it says, you know, do you want candidate A, B, C, D, E, F, G, you know, and now rank them? I mean, how does that work for a voter? Yeah, I mean, that's really tough. And as you say, I mean, voters who don't speak English as their first language, all these things create, you know, we're like putting burden on top of burden until people just won't vote.
Well, I sometimes wonder if that's what the left wants, is they want us all to just stay home because they'd rather just run it without us. But I know the Alaska State Supreme Court ruled that the election officials who ran the election in 2022 basically misunderstood and misapplied the statute. And they affirmed a lower court ruling who had found that they misapplied the statute as it related to a candidate who'd withdrawn after the date for withdrawal. You know, there are so many things as it is that are complicated about elections. We need to try to make it simpler, not more complicated. Yeah. And I sort of worry, you know, people hearing all this will say, oh, this makes my head hurt. And the reason and it does make our heads hurt, but it's going to make our heads hurt a lot worse if these whack jobs who are funded by these left-wing billionaires are able to get these systems enacted. And they're being proposed all over the country,
yeah.
Right? So tell us what you've been doing on all this, because you've been fighting this. And how many legislatures have you testified in front of this year?
Oh, I've lost count, but we've been all over with, so I also co-chair a group called Stop RCV. We've got a website,
StopRCV is ranked choice voting. What is that website, Trent?
StopRCV.com is the website there. And we're trying to build that up with a lot of resources against ranked choice voting. Cause that's the one of all these systems that's being pushed the most. And in some ways, I really think it's the worst. It's, you know, the most convoluted. But we're working with groups around the country to just try to educate legislators, you know, people who work in politics, because a lot of folks just haven't heard of these things, don't realize what's behind them or what the downsides are. And then obviously just educate ordinary voters about, you know, what's out there, why these things are being pushed, why it's important to stand up for the system that we have that really, you know, I mean, no election system is ever going to be perfect, right? Or perfectly administered, because ultimately all of these involve human beings doing math, for one thing, which I never do perfectly. So, you know, there's always going to be some level of complexity and some potential for error, but, you know, protecting a system that's simple enough, that it can be transparent enough, that it can be trustworthy enough, that it can be a functioning democratic process in our republic. I mean, that is something worth fighting for. And so that's, you know, that's what we've been working on at Stop RCV and at Save Our States.
Well, yeah, we're in the Election Integrity Network. We created an RCV, a Stop RCV working group, national working group, to help try to get citizens involved. And is there a place for citizens to sign up on your website if they want to get information, or is it mainly organizations or what?
We have an email list on our website. I believe we've just been making some additions to our website. I think it's still there. People can go and sign up. People can follow us on social media at Facebook and on Twitter. We're constantly pushing out these stories of, you know, the kind of the horror stories about ranked choice voting, and trying to help make sure that people, you know, even if you're out in the Northeast, you know what's going on in Oakland, California, and vice versa. So we love to have folks stay in touch with us. I mean, the power of what we've done at Save Our States really has been so much the power of grassroots engaging directly with their state legislators. So that's my vision for what we're doing on ranked choice voting, is just get the information out to patriotic American citizens who want to stand up for what we have, and you know, and then help people connect with their state legislators. That's a huge part of the battle. And I know, you know, at the Election Integrity Network, that's you know, really the core of the great work that you all have been doing.
Well, we have had great success working with groups like AMAC, the Association of Mature American Citizens. Their grassroots people are fabulous, and they've really been actively involved in trying to stop ranked choice voting in several states. The Election Integrity, the Election Transparency Initiative, which is chaired by former Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli and his great executive director, Michael Barrs. They were very instrumental in stopping an effort in Utah. You know, if people want to participate, they can go to your website, stoprcv.org.com.
I think they both are the same place.
And go to our website at whoscounting.us, and there's a place to sign up. And if you're interested in this topic, you could join the national working group that meets to talk about what's going on. But it's going to take all of us being really vigilant about these, soul crushing and system crushing and republic crushing proposals that are coming and funded by these, as I say, the leftist billionaires who really don't like our country for some unknown reason. But Trent, you really do the Lord's work translating all this craziness into something that people can understand. And I'm going to go away from this with the knowledge that what this all requires is a mathematical literacy test, and that's unconstitutional.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate you.
Thank you. It's great to be on the program, and thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you very much. And that's it for this week. And we urge you to please subscribe to the podcast, whoscounting.us, Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. Go to our website, whoscounting.us, sign up to help. If you want to sign up and help specifically as well on RCV, ranked choice voting, go to stoprcv.com. And share this episode with your friends, because big tech likes to sanction and deplatform and silence us, but it's going to take all of us working together to save our election systems, and that's what we're doing to try to save our country. So with that, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Please help us fight big tech censorship. Like and subscribe to this podcast and be sure to share it with your friends. You can become part of this election integrity movement by signing up to join the Election Integrity Network. Go to whoscounting.us. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Election Integrity Network.